Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Rachel, exclusively on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the show. Welcome back from a weekend. Today is Monday, September 18th. Rachel's not in today, and I'm joined by the guest co-host, whose name is Kay Brand.
Good Kay, morning.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Back, actually. You've been here quite a few times. Kay is a friend of the station, a friend of the show, and she's always here.
Always here.
When we invite her, that is.
I just hang out in the hallway, and I wait for you to take pity on me and invite me in.
Yeah, maybe we'll throw a few bucks your way or something, right? Then you can get a McDonald's.
Wait a second. You mean I actually make money?
Somebody's got to, right? Yeah. So, Kay, tell a little bit about yourself so people could know. What do you do?
I'm a bad girl.
You're a bad girl.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I know you're a writer and you're a movie maker and everything. So why are you a bad girl?
Because I am known as an adult filmmaker, otherwise known as a pornographer.
Okay. So that makes you naughty or I guess, right?
Yeah. I live in the subculture.
Yeah.
I live in the dark shadows. I'm an author as well. I have 22 books this Friday. I have a new book coming out on Friday, erotic books, 21 erotic books, and one horror novel.
So that's a lot of books in you.
I have a lot. Yeah, it's a lot of books. But Friday, the sequel in my BDSM series, At Mother's Command, is out, is published. And then next month, or at the beginning of November, I have a novel called Naked coming out, which is what my latest movie is based on.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And and the story of how you fell into it was kind of a long story, you know?
It's a long story.
So we're not going to get into it again.
Yeah.
But you definitely have, I find you to be smart and entertaining.
Thanks.
So obviously you have things to write about. And, you know, so there you go, you know. Now, let me ask you this. So you do all this. Now, does sex play a big part of your life? I mean, just in general, you don't have to get into details. But, I mean, is it an important part? I mean, do you have to be sexual to write about these things?
No, definitely, because you don't have to be, but you know, because writing is all in the head anyway. It's all imagination, and you know, there definitely, I know plenty of erotic authors who claim to base their books on their personal life, and I don't know, you know, I don't know. There's some of it, you know. I mean, what I draw from, I think a lot of times the emotional connections in my book are usually come from fairly honest places, and whether that comes from me or just being able to tap in to the characters that is where that, you know.
That's
Have
you always been writing? I mean, even
always.
Before you got into this genre?
I wrote my first book when I was 4 years old.
Wow.
Yeah,
really?
It was a short story that made absolutely no sense, but my parents actually bound it, and it's somewhere.
Wow.
Somewhere. But yeah, and that was a theater. I owned a theater company in the 90s in LA, and I've written, directed, produced at least 25 stage plays. So, and
You're quite a body of work.
And I've directed 50 plus movies since 2009 in the adult industry. Yeah,
that's got to be more than Steven Spielberg. So there you go. Some kind of a record there.
Exactly.
Well, we're talking about authors. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by one who is very interesting. The book seems like amazing to me. You know, it's going to take us into places in our imagination that I think we don't go very often.
No, awesome.
You know? Yeah, so that would be cool. And weekend. You know, did you feel like the summer's kind of over?
I hate that feeling.
Really?
I hate that feeling. I love the summer. Summer is my favorite season.
Yeah, it's nice. But, you know, you don't live in the valley here where it's very hot, right?
I live in another valley called Santa Clarita. It's hotter there than it is in the valley. Wow. Oh, yeah. Well, we had a really intense heat wave in August. We had like two straight weeks of temperatures that were between 110 and 118 degrees every single day.
Yeah,
it was really tough. And then suddenly we had like this weird storm that blew in, a lightning storm, and then rain and wind. And I think we were just having sympathy pains for all the hurricanes.
There you go. And we got some water in the last winter, actually. We got some rain for a change.
Yeah.
So that was nice. I hope we get some more this year. I love rain. I love summer too, you know, but now is the perfect California weather. You know? In the 70s, clear skies, that's what we need here. That's why people move here. One of the reasons.
Yeah.
So there you go. All the other reasons is because Hollywood is waiting for them, right? With open hands. Just come to LA, you're going to be successful.
Just come to LA and you'll be working at Starbucks.
Yeah.
it's just horrible. That's you know, the true. Thing is about being in the arts, being in the entertainment industry one way or another for like three decades now, it's sad when I look back and I think about all the actors that were in my theater company and that maybe one or two of them actually had some real work, you know.
Right.
And then nothing.
Right.
You know, we just don't hear about them. Never even heard anything more from them once I closed my theater company. And it's just how it is. It's the percent. It's 11% of all actors in the United States actually make a living.
Yeah,
11%.
Right? Wow. You see, that's the thing. And people come here and they claim, oh, I'm an actor. And they don't work. They don't do anything.
Right.
I'm an actor. Okay. But what are you going to do? You know, until you get paid, it's a hobby. So get a job.
Yep.
You know?
That's the same way I feel about writing books.
Yeah. Right.
Because it's just tough.
It is tough. But
it is.
You know what? It's everything in entertainment and things like this is tough because I guess, you know, sometimes I wonder why do people go through such hard time or through so many difficulties to try and be famous and be successful. And the thing is, look, the rewards are large, okay? I mean, look at the Emmys last night. You know, people are like successful.
Yeah.
They're famous. They're rich.
Yeah.
That's what people want, you know? So they figure, okay, well, maybe I'll fail, but at least I'm trying.
11%.
You know? 11%.
And that's, you know, and that's an accurate number.
And those are not really the stars either, you know. This is like everybody out of everybody.
That includes people who only do commercials. I know one person that who's been able to make a living for two decades now doing commercials only.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because like I've seen her now through the years be wife. And now she's older wife, older mom. She's heading into like the young grandmother commercials. You know, like I've watched her age over.
Yeah, right.
And she's always doing the prescription, the new prescription drugs, the new drug that those ones that have like giant disclaimers at the end where you're like, I am terrified of these disclaimers. Like I would never take this drug just based on the things that might happen if I take it, you know,
exactly.
Are worse than what you're trying to deal with, I think.
It is. And it creates all kinds of side effects. Then you take something else to counter the side effects, and it goes on and on and on. You know, it's pretty crazy with all what's going on with this stuff. But yeah, going back to and that's the thing. Look, they have the fine print in the newspapers, magazine too, but we don't read it. But when they tell it to you on, you know, side effects include a rash or death. Even death, right? It's like okay, I'll
a
take
stroke,
that. Right?
A heart attack, uncontrollable bleeding, vomiting, headaches.
Yeah. Psychotic episodes.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you. No, thank you. Yeah. I'll take the multiple personalities. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's just not
worth
it.
That's true, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know, man. But I know some people that live, you know, I mean, they stay alive thanks to drugs. You can't deny that.
Oh, 100%.
So many, you know, but I also think we keep people alive way too long, you know?
Oh, come on.
No, really. I mean, look, like, for example, I mean, I love him to death, but my dad's got Parkinson's, all right? His like memory is almost shot, you know. It's like he doesn't remember things.
Yeah.
He has to have
inhumane.
Everything done for him, you know, diaper, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
It is inhumane.
It is.
It's like, why do we have to maintain people to this point, you know?
Because you
saying?
We can't just kill them.
Exactly.
We treat dogs better.
Exactly. But yeah, that's the thing. So life sometimes can be cruel, even if you live a long time. So
yeah.
I don't think you want to outlive your usefulness, pretty much, you know.
Harry Dean Stanton died at 91
last week.
Yeah. And it's crazy. Like, when I saw that, because a friend of mine owns a company called the Dearly Departed, LA's Dearly Departed. They do not the Graveline tours, but he does the, the tour of famous murders and where okay. people have died.
Right.
So it's a very macabre tour. Uh-huh. And I took it a couple years ago, and it really upset me.
Really?
It freaked me out. Because Whoa. Then you just realize just how random these kind of murders are, and how, like, really about being in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's not funny, but, you know, it's heavy.
It does happen, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then, like, even things like driving by the old Menendez brothers' house in Beverly Hills, and you just see it's like this big house in a beautiful neighborhood, and somebody else lives there now. Somebody else bought the house, even though there was this really horrific murder that happened there when they killed their parents, when the Menendez brothers killed their parents. And he has a recording on the tour that he plays audio, you know, in the van, and that says, that was an interview saying with one of the Menendez brothers saying that after all the machine gun, and they were like, the brothers were just basically, they sat there waiting to hear sirens. They thought sirens were going to come immediately because they just blew up their house and murdered their parents, and
Jeez.
Not blew it up, but, you know, blew it up with machine gun fire.
Right.
And nobody called.
No, huh?
Nobody even came out of their house.
They got a new TV movie again about the Menendez brothers coming up.
It's crazy.
And I'm going, I was asking myself, I mean, do we still care about this?
We don't, but there's no, and then the worst part is not that there's a shortage of material.
Right.
We've had this conversation before about when I used to have meetings at CAA and ICM, and you go, how many agents actually work here? Because all of those agents have clients, and most of them are writers. You know, it's like, if you're competing against all of those other people, that's when it really, like, becomes crystal clear that it's a phenomenal stroke of luck for anybody, for any writer to make it.
To break out.
Yeah, phenomenal stroke of luck, because the competition is huge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, what can you do? The thing is that there's not as many jobs as there are people wanting those jobs, you know, and that's what happens, you know. People realize they're unemployed and stuff. That's why I always say, get a day job too. You got to support yourself. And nobody tells them not to pursue acting, but or whatever. But do it with, I don't think you have to live poor all your life just because you have a dream to be an actor.
No, you have to have an escape plan,
right?
Or something else that you do. But the thing about writing is that it takes a long time
to
write. You can take all the seminars you want about how to turn out a script in 30 days, and that's fine. You can do that. But so what? You know, like, it doesn't mean that it's going to get made just because you wrote it in 30 days. It doesn't mean that it puts you, you've even turned out anything that's remarkable, because that's the thing about development. You know, I've had so many projects in development over the years in mainstream, and you spend a lot of time completely wasted, you know, downtime just waiting for some executive to finally say, okay, now this script goes.
Right.
Now this script is going to get made. And even then, you know, there was one time when I had three scripts at major studios with major talent attached, major director, major actors, and nothing. The script went into turnaround. Wow. And turnaround is this horrible thing that no writer wants to hear, which means that it was going this way and now it's going the opposite direction. Like, it was going towards the open door and now it's going back to the basement. You know, so that's and there's nothing you can do about it. There's absolutely nothing you can do about it. So if you spend 3 years with, and that's not an exaggeration,
right?
Scripts sit in development for years.
Well, go find another job, folks. Enough with that stuff. All right. Well, we're gonna bring in our guest who's sitting here patiently, and I'm dying to talk to her. We're joined by an author, and she's got this big book.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, right?
That's a lot of writing.
It's a lot of writing.
Yeah.
And we're joined by Vanta M. Black. Welcome to the show.
thank you. And my book is in development for a TV show, and I think now I just want to crawl into my own oubliette.
No. Don't take us as
an
example.
After that lead-in, wow.
I know. That was
so
pretty
sad.
That was pretty gloomy, but no, I mean.
it's better than having people say, pursue your dreams, and everything's going to be, just believe in yourself. And then you realize that there's a giant structure that you're working against with all that confidence,
yeah,
you know?
That's true.
You guys are keeping it real, I got to say that.
But I'm sure you know this stuff. You've lived in L.A.
Absolutely.
You know what
you
get into.
The cool thing about living in L.A., though, what I find is if you kind of keep your fingers in a lot of different pots, it's almost like playing the lottery.
It's a numbers game.
It is a numbers game, right?
That's true.
You know, if you've got a 1 in 10 chance of being an actor, you need to go out for 10 different auditions, because the law of averages says you're going to get 1 out of 10. So if you start thinking about it that way, and thinking about it, too, as a business person, I think a lot of people they love the art and they love to be creative, and sometimes they forget that there's a lot of business involved, too.
Yeah, that's true, and that's a main problem for artists, because they don't think of the business side of things, you know?
Yeah.
But you got to think of who's going to buy your stuff. How are you going to monetize this, you know? All these things that people don't know. And then they wonder why nobody buys their stuff, you know? Well, you have great stuff, but nobody knows about it or whatever.
Well, the marketing and the promotion is huge for everything. I mean, I never stop promoting my books. And it's sometimes just like, oh, my God. Like, do I really have to do another Facebook post about one of my books just to get somebody to buy one copy? And that's on 99 cents, you know? I'm walking with 35 cents.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I do. You know?
So. I know. Well, but at least you get to do what you love to do.
I feel very lucky that. But it doesn't mean that,
it's a consolation.
Having the financial reward is part of it, you know? And there's only so long you can do things for the love of it before you go, okay, can I please be able to pay for my car payment this month with this, you know? So.
Exactly, yeah. Well, Vanta, I'm sure you've considered all these things and everything when you got into writing. How long have you been writing now?
Probably about 12 years at this point.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So you write fiction. Do you write any nonfiction at all?
I do a little bit, but my main, you know.
You love to tell stories.
I love to tell stories.
Wow, that's awesome. Did you start writing early on, too, in your life?
You know, it was funny, Kay, when you said that, because I remembered when I was probably about 5 or 6, my first book was called Raindrops.
Oh.
So I do think that it starts really young, doesn't it? Where we you know, experiment. And it's really nice, too, that your parents encourage that, because that's the other thing, too, is I think when we're little and we're exploring whether we're drawing or writing or doing whatever, to have that encouragement behind
us. Yeah, the parents really have to support you on that, you know, because that's who you look for support and confirmation, you know, that what you're doing is okay, you know. So that's very good. And so did you keep on writing as you grew up, or was it something you picked up later?
I've done a lot of things.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I do consider myself a creative individual, and the fact that I'm artistic. I am also a marketer, and I understand the marketing aspect of things. So I'm a little bit of a jack of all trades at this point.
And you're ahead of the game, too, if you understand how the game is played, right? Like book writing and publishing. Also, we were talking about competitiveness and everything. Very difficult, right?
Mm-hmm. Very difficult
to get into.
And I do think the monetary aspect of it, absolutely. Who doesn't want to make money?
Right.
But I do think there are other rewards. We as human beings, we have different needs and wants.
Right.
And a lot of times it's just figuring out, what does somebody really want? What do I really want? Do I want to be filthy rich? Sure, that's nice, but I also really just like telling stories,
right.
And I like it when people enjoy them, and I love the process, because when I was writing Oubliette, I thought to myself, if one person reads this and enjoys it, I've reached my goal as a writer.
Really?
And
that's
I think
amazing.
If you think about what you really want to accomplish, because I do see a lot of people where it's like, I need money, I get it, we need to make those car payments, but if that's your only motivator, those types of people I see fail more often than the ones that are doing it because it's a passion and because they have other motivators for doing what they do.
Exactly. I got to say, I don't think that is true at all when it comes to erotic books or erotic authors. I know a lot of authors that write strictly genres that they know will sell.
Yeah,
and their heart's not in it.
But that's more a commercial side of things, right? That maybe they don't do it because of their passion. But
and they've made a lot of money, but they're not necessarily writing their best work.
Right.
They're not necessarily writing their...
So they're writing commercially, you know? That's
what
I'm saying.
They figured out. But there was also a time and place. There was a time and place for on Amazon, especially where... erotic authors made a ton of money.
Really?
It is not that way anymore.
Erotica and the romance genre too, those, they're kind of a different animal when you start talking about fiction and when you compare how they do against, you know, your horror and sci-fi and fantasy.
Oh, I think
and
horror is worse. I have, because it's overwhelmingly saturated very, very difficult to get a book recognized on Amazon in the horror genre. I have a horror novel that's been out for 2 years.
But what I'm saying is that I do know romance authors, and they've got it down to a science. So that goes back to what I was saying earlier. If you treat it like a business, you can do very well.
Right. That's my publisher, and that's how she works. She's a New York Times bestselling author, and I made her book into a movie last year. I made two of her books into movies,
actually. Good for you.
Yeah, Selena Kent.
So here you go. You know, you have a little secret of how to succeed in book writing. Publishing... I know it's an established but competitive field as well. So, okay, but we beat that to death.
Let's
talk about the book now.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So, Vanta Black, you wrote the book called Oubliette and A Forgotten Little Place, inspired by true events, and it looks like a scary cover. Tell us a little bit about the general plot of this story.
So do you know, Sam, what an oubliette is?
I don't.
It literally, literally means a forgotten little place. And it was a pit or a hole inside of castles where they would throw people to forget about them. It was basically a death sentence.
Wow.
And when I first heard the concept, they were talking about the oubliette inside of Lepp Castle in Ireland, which is the most haunted castle in Ireland. And they talked about how they pulled out the bones from over 150 different people. And this was over the course of many centuries. And I thought all of these people came together in this one place for all of these different reasons. It could have been they were a criminal, war crimes. Maybe they were standing in the way of somebody's inheritance, so they were murdered. And I just thought, wouldn't it be cool if... we took that concept and wrote the backstories of all of these different people inside of this oubliette. Wow. So I took that idea. I set my oubliette inside of a castle in France because France is more fun than Ireland.
Really?
However, I did go to Lepp Castle. I visited it.
Really?
I called up the owner. And this isn't one of those castles where you go and you visit and you go through the guided tour. I called up the owner who lives there, and I was like, I heard about your castle. I'm this lady from America, and I want to kind of use it as inspiration. Can I come visit you? And his name is Sean Ryan, and he was so sweet. He was like, yes, of course. And we made arrangements.
And he owns this?
He owns it, and he's restoring it as well.
How much would something like this cost? I mean, it's like priceless, right?
It is priceless.
So he's like hugely rich.
I don't know about that. Yeah. I think
so
too.
How did he buy it? I mean, how
I don't know how he bought it. I don't know the financial aspect.
Yeah,
but
how does
by
he own
visiting
it?
Him, I would not say he's a rich man. If
really?
That makes sense, yeah.
Okay, so I'm just curious to know how he got to be the owner of a castle, but you know, anyway.
Inheritance. Maybe he got it in a foreclosure.
Yeah. But, you know, I would think, like, castles like this from the past would be, like, historic things. And
landmarks.
Would be owned by the government or something. So that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So you went there. You actually went there. How big a castle is it? Huge?
It is huge. And the area that we were in, I mean, it was built up over time, which actually is kind of an inspiration that I used for my castle, too. It was a fortress. And when you're standing there, you can see for miles and miles. And you understand why, you know, back in pagan days when they were being invaded, they could see the enemy coming.
Right.
You know, the walls
themselves. That's why they
built
on high ground, right?
Very high ground, but not like on a mountain. It was just like on this hilltop, this sloping hilltop.
Yeah.
And the walls themselves were like 6 feet thick.
Really?
So it was just inspiring to be inside of there. And there was a whole nother section that was very decrepit, and they had blocked it off. They weren't even working on that part of it. The place that I specifically wanted to go to was a room called the Bloody Chapel, which is up the stairs. So you go up the winding staircase, and you're up there, and the oubliette is in there. And you kind of, you look into this hole, and then it's like you would have to crawl a little bit. I didn't do that. And then it drops off.
Oh, so they can't get out.
No.
No way.
So the whole idea of an oubliette is you fall in and you're not getting out. Sometimes they would put spikes in the bottom, not necessarily to kill you outright, but to impale you and make your death that much worse.
Wow.
And what they would do, too, is, you know, here's our enemy. We just tossed him down there. We're going to sit up here and have a party, a feast. And there's going to be music and laughter, and they're going to smell the food while they're sitting down there literally starving to death, without being able to participate. So if you can imagine, when you talk about death and dying, right, you know, dying knowing that there are human beings 12 feet above you that don't give a crap about you and that are basically just going to shove it in your face. This is life, and you're about ready to die.
Wow. So that's why I didn't, because I was going to ask you, why did they just come out straight out and kill them, you know? But this was a slow death.
This was a mean way to get rid of somebody,
wow.
Yes.
Do you remember Silence of the Lambs?
Yes.
There was an oubliette of sorts in that one.
Really?
Well, the main crazy guy.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Dropped her in a...
That's right, that little hole.
To starve her.
The ditch, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Actually, I think he was fattening her up, wasn't he?
Oh, that's right.
Because he wanted to wear her skin.
That's right.
He needed her one size bigger.
That's right,
How do people think about this shit, man? I'm telling you. But let me ask you this. So you became fascinated by this. How did you first discover the concept of oubliette? Did you know about it? I mean,
I was just watching one of those. It was actually around Halloween when they do those mysterious and haunted places shows.
Right.
And they were featuring Lepp Castle. And when I saw that, it was just like that little nugget of inspiration.
Wow.
And when I first started writing the story, it was more of an anthology. All of these different stories took place around this oubliette, but they weren't necessarily connected.
Right.
And then as I wrote it, I started like finding ways to connect it.
Ah.
And then I brought in this modern day storyline of two sisters who are drawn to this castle. And so there's relics from the past and things that happen that kind of bring it all together in the end.
Wow. That's a complex story. How long does it take to write something like that?
So this took me 10 years to
really?
Write it. Yeah. And I'm not looking to make $1 million off of
it,
because
you deserve
something.
Way to do it. Crying out loud.
I just want to share the story.
Yeah, I just
want people to like it. That's all.
Yeah,
you know, and
right?
enjoy it and live in... I'm very visceral. I'm not sure about you, Kay, but when I write, it's all about what are you feeling? And the idea of being in this closed environment, like how do you describe that?
Right.
That's a horror in and of itself. That's just very visceral and real.
And you
real.
Have to get into it, sort of like imagine what it was like. That's amazing that people will go in their mind to these places, you know.
But that's what writing is, and that's what reading is. And that's why a book is so much different and always will be different than anything else from TV, movies, etc. It's just a different form of storytelling. And why I love the novel and why I love writing and reading is because it's taking place in the mind. It's probably closer to radio, because this conversation is taking place in the listener's mind right now. They're imagining what we look like. And they, you know, kind of are getting a picture painted as they go. Books are the same way.
Yeah.
And as an author, if you can paint that picture and bring somebody into your world so that they can feel it, then, in my opinion, you win.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think many people wonder why some films don't do well based on good novels, like Stephen King, for example, the clearest. Many of the movies based on his books really failed. And that's because the storytelling is not the same. It's somebody else's vision of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went through this when doing my adaptations.
Really?
And because I've made 5 movies now all based on books over the past 2 years. And when I was creating Babysitting the Baumgartners, the Selena Kitt's New York Times bestseller and USA Today bestselling novel, I wanted her to be really happy during that transition, during the adaptation process. And she approved everything from the script to the cast. She was involved with all the decision making. And I would read a chapter before we filmed it, and so that the performers could understand that a kiss had to be placed here at the end of this sentence or at the end of this dialogue, or a touch had to happen here at the while this is being said, because in the book this is exactly what it says. Yeah. He touched her doing this. He rubbed her shoulder. He, you know, gave her a hug. He gave her a kiss on the cheek and then said it. And I wanted all of that so that her fans could read along the book as they were watching the movie and see all the details. So like with writers, we write in details. Yeah. You need those details.
You really do, you know, and in the movie you don't have time to show.
But they do. That's what I'm saying. It's, really? It's a certain, of course. But but it's the director's choice to either stick to the material word for word as closely as possible and catch the nuances or not.
Or take artistic freedom and go.
Or just do like a broad stroke movie, you know, where they're just like doing like the big cinematic thing. But even then, the details are, I mean, I caught some details in Babysitting the Baumgartners that Selena didn't even recognize from her book. You know, that was like, and I had to remind her that she wrote that, you know, so, but anybody can do it. It's just a matter of how the director, it's the director's choice. You know, like I had this thing about the Harry Potter movies and wondering if I really liked them. I think the last one was probably my favorite one, but there were times when I was like, ew, God, they didn't do this and they didn't do that and they changed and they moved this. And in a case like that, I guess you have to, but they kept as many details as they possibly could, but I still think there was more.
Right. No, absolutely. I just saw the movie It.
And
have you read the book, guys?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a very thick book, obviously. Yeah. But I thought, you know, it's presented as a horror film. To me, Stephen King is always about the characters. He often writes about children and you know, and teenagers and stuff. Uh-huh. So to me, it's not so much a horror story as about the relationship with the kids. So as they were telling the story in the film, the time is running out. I'm like, they're not even showing them as adults. What's going on here? They're only showing them as kids. I said, there's no way they're going to squeeze that book in 2 hours.
Sure enough,
at the end, it said It, Chapter 1. You know, so they're going to continue this now. And sure enough, you know, so you know when you read a book, you know right away if the story is complete or not, you know.
Well, they did made it into a miniseries back in the 80s they or did. 90s, whenever that was.
With Tim Curry.
And I remember hating that miniseries, like, because I had just finished the book, too. And it was like, this is lame. Like, it wasn't even a good, you know.
I know. Yeah. I know, the monster and all that. But, cool. So we're talking to Vanta M. Black, and she wrote an amazing book that we're talking about, Oubliette, which is a French word, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. Now, was that because the French invented this? Is this what happened? Did they think of it first?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure if they thought of it first or if that's just the, you know, they gave their oubliettes in their castle that name and then it became ubiquitous after that.
But right, right.
It's funny because you find these apparently in a lot of castles and it's just a concept that Kay recognized it because she's a writer and she was saying that she had used it in the past. But I actually find about 1 in 10 people have heard of it. And a lot of times they've heard of it because of the David Bowie movie Labyrinth. There was an oubliette in there. Or, you know, they've heard of it somewhere. There was a X-Files episode as well called Oubliette. So they have a vague understanding of what it is. But the reality is there were a lot of oubliettes in a lot of castles. And maybe it's just a matter of, you know, as society matures, you want to forget that dark side of your past. So you don't necessarily talk about these, you know, very specific dungeons. We know there are dungeons. This is actually a type of dungeon. is what it boils down to.
No, but you weaved a fictional story about this, and there's a main character, right? Mm-hmm. Veronica?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about how all this works together. I mean, we're talking about dungeons and pits and things like this, and suddenly we're talking about a girl or a woman, Veronica?
She's a woman. She's and in the woman. Past, she was haunted by night terrors. And night terrors are real things.
For sure.
And I actually, when I was younger, when I was about 12 years old, 13 years old, I was haunted by night terrors. And what would happen is I'd be asleep and suddenly become lucid. In other words, I was awake. I was aware I was asleep, but I couldn't move. Mm-hmm. Sleep paralysis is what it's called.
Wow.
And I would feel a very mean, angry presence in the room that was hell-bent on doing something very, very bad to me. It was just like this overwhelming feeling of doom and dread. At times, it would feel almost like a thing with hair crawling along the side
Good
of
Lord.
My body. And the only way I could make this thing go away was to wake up screaming. So the struggle was, imagine being paralyzed, not able to move, to blink, to lash out, and all of my energy went into waking up screaming, and for whatever reason, that would make the thing go away. As I grew up, I found out that this phenomenon is actually quite common.
Yeah.
It's called different things in different cultures. So it was a little bit nice to know that I wasn't necessarily crazy, because I really did feel like, what's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. And I have a very scientific, analytical mind. I was like, this can't be true. This has to be my mind playing tricks. It's some kind of a dream state, whatever. But when I started hearing about other cultures, like it's called the old hag, and it's different versions in different cultures have it as some kind of a witch or a succubus or an incubus, things that we've heard about in cultures where it tries to steal your soul as you're sleeping. And there are just numerous different versions of this, which kind of leads me to believe, again, I can't say it's true. I know what I experienced. But with all of these different people in different times talking about essentially the same thing, it has to be something.
Right.
And what it is,
like
I don't know.
You picked it up from somewhere or anything, right? This just came to you. This just happened.
Yeah.
It's not like you've seen it anywhere.
I think with a lot of child psychologists say that it's a coping mechanism for stress that children,
what do you
know,
think it is? What do you think it is?
I don't know. Yeah. And I'm not... Again, it happened to me, and I know it was real. The real crazy thing is, okay, for many years, I just dismissed it. And I saw studies where they could use electromagnetic energy, mm-hmm. and they could simulate it in the brain. I'm like, okay, that's what it was. It makes sense now. Problem solved. When I was about, in my early 20s, and I was dating my now husband... Again, remember, when I needed to make these things go away, I needed to wake up screaming.
Yes.
So we were watching TV. It was on a timer. The TV went off. My husband, who was then my boyfriend, looked over, and I had fallen asleep. And he was contemplating, should I get up and turn off the TV, wake her up? Like, what should I leave? And leave her a note. And all of a sudden, he saw this shadow figure standing in the doorway. And it was looking at me. And he was like, what the hell?
Wow.
And he looked at me, and he looked at it, and it was just like zeroing in on me. And at that moment, I woke up, sat up straight, screamed. He looked back. The thing disappeared. I laid back down and went to sleep. Here's the thing. He never told me about that episode until about 3 years after we were married, which was nearly 8 years after that
Amazing.
Moment.
Wow.
And when he did that, and that's about the time I was starting to write this book, you know, I got the shivers, and I was just like, you just rocked my world, because for so long I had thought I found the scientific explanation.
Right.
And now you're telling me I never told him about that. I didn't want him to think I was nuts. And he had not told me, because he didn't want me to think he was crazy.
All right. Do you believe in past lives?
I think if there is anything out there, and I'm an atheist, actually, but I think if there is something, then past lives make more sense than anything else. Because
right.
if we do have some kind of a...
Like a soul.
Yeah, if that exists, then it can't make sense that some people live on this planet for 2 minutes and others for 100 years.
Right.
Like, it has to be fair.
Well, even being an atheist, this must be very weird to even hear your husband tell you that there was a shadow figure. That must just be... impossible to wrap your brain around as an atheist.
It is. That's what I mean. When people ask me, do you believe this stuff? Because there's a certain... People assume that I believe in the metaphysical and ghosts and things. I'm not saying I don't. I guess in a lot of ways I'm agnostic to it. I'm curious. But even feeling and experiencing what I did, I'm still like... I don't know, because it doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
I want it to be tangible.
I think from a metaphysical standpoint, the theory would probably be that you are drawing energy from a past experience, from a past life,
probably.
From a past...
I think if there's a soul, then there has to be reincarnation. And, you know, and that's what you were talking about. You know, people come here to this planet for different reasons. And, You know, some of them accomplish what they need to accomplish in a few years, and then they die. You know, so it's a lot of different things, and all we can do is just theorize about it.
Right.
Nobody's ever going to know, and I think it's better that way. You know, it makes us better people because
definitely the mystery of life.
It gives you free will. You know, mm-hmm. if you knew what you would, what was going to happen, then you don't have free will anymore.
I think Bhante should read from her book.
Yeah, well, there's so much more to talk about, though. So that's why I was wondering. Now, this book is written like during what period? Like, when did this happen?
So the main storyline of the two sisters, they're from LA, and they're drawn to this castle. So that's modern day times. Right. And then there's different, and as you're reading, actually, I put the times and the eras in there so people could have the reference. I have during the time of the Reformation, the French Revolution, during the time of pagans, when the Gauls and...
Tons of research.
But also probably a lot of just from reading over the years, right? You got a lot of this, I know. Because you accumulate all that knowledge as you go. It's not like you have to do all the research for the book, right?
A lot of validating. Right. I mean, you hear about fact-checking things, but you need to
Right. And that's very good. So you had to picture what it was like living during those times, right? Mm-hmm. Did you read like any novels that dealt with those time periods?
Oh, yeah, a lot of reading and a lot of novels, and even like the other Boland sister was one of the ones that I was reading along the times that I was writing a lot of this, and just kind of imagining the eras and the clothes they wore. You know, I do have Dorothea's story is set during the 1500s. So looking up and seeing what would her world have been like.
Right.
You know, at that point, China just started importing stuff. The ships just started arriving. So I'm like, well, she would be sitting on Chinese silk pillows and drinking tea, which was a very new thing. So stuff like that was kind of exciting to think about.
Those details are amazing when you uncover them and you can put them in your story.
And they're just little nuggets, right?
Right.
They color the picture, they color the landscape of the imagination when somebody's reading it for the reader.
That's true. And sometimes some authors just meander so much, you know, talking about Stephen King again. But sometimes you can read the story without reading parts of it.
Well, you know, it was the first book that he he did not have his publisher giving him a word count over his head. That was the first one where he was able to just go as far as he wanted with it, which is why it's over at that.
Yeah, that's why he did. But Vanta Black, the book is Oubliette. Meaning a forgotten little place. And so they would just send people there. I mean, I can't imagine a worse ending than that to your life.
Oh, I can. Oh, sure.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, those are the ways, right? I mean, all the methods of torture they used to have during those times.
Oh,
right? Wow. So, now, were you fascinated by history and the past before that? I mean, is that why it came?
Yeah, I think so.
You want to like travel to those different times and stuff. Wow, that's pretty cool. You should write like a time travel story. I love those. But at any rate, so you have the two sisters, right? They're like the main characters and everything. Mm-hmm. And then they sort of like...
So as they go to this castle, and they're there to renovate it. They're going to turn it into an inn. They were hired
to
go there.
Now, is that a real castle in France that you...
It's fictitious, but I actually went to France, and I went to Loire Valley, where this is set, which is a place of castles. If you ever go to France, take the TGV like I did and visit. You'll see the castle that inspired Sleeping Beauty. You'll see just... I went to Amboise, where Leonardo da Vinci is buried. His crypt is there. So there's all of these different castles. And seriously,
very cool.
Hundreds of castles. So it very well could have been a castle. I went there to kind of see how they looked and felt when I designed my fictitious castle for the book.
Wow. That's very cool. You know, I mean, I salute you for doing this. You see? And after 10 years of doing something like this, you have your baby out, right? So this is about to be published? It's not published.
It's already out.
Oh, it is already out. So tell people where they can find it.
It's on Amazon. That's probably the easiest. Barnes & Noble, Kobo, iTunes, or iBooks, I should say. You can just go to my website if you want to find it, vantamblack.com.
Okay, sounds good. Oubliette, French name. I'm still trying to say it right.
You did great.
That was it.
Yeah. And no, I pronounce it differently because, you see, I know some French, but not a lot. So I can understand it, but I can't really write it or, you know.
You know how to say garçon in a restaurant.
Garçon. No, I don't know that one. Is that from the movie?
Waiter.
Yeah, from the movie.
No, you're just calling a waiter.
Oh, okay. No, my French is always, but of course, you know. But of course,
very
I do
Pepe
this.
Very Pepe Le Pew.
Yeah. Like, yeah, Pepe Le Pew is my favorite cartoon character, incidentally, because he's a hopeless romantic.
He's a romancer.
Right? He doesn't
he
take
loves
no
the ladies.
Answer, you know? I love that, you know? Even though they're cats. And not skunks, you know? But I like his optimism, you know?
Right.
Because I try to adopt that.
He's a smooth operator. He never gives up. He absolutely believes that he's gonna make the romance connection happen.
Yeah,
with another cat who doesn't want anything to do with him.
Right, you know, exactly. He stinks, you know. He doesn't realize that he smells and why everybody gets away from him. So then he locks the cat in a room, right? And they show him
mon chéri.
He's holding the key to the room and he goes, I'm the locksmith of love, no?
A little bit rapey now, right?
Yeah.
When we look back, it's like, oh.
It is, right?
That's kind of rapey.
I know.
So much of all of that, though. Like, you watch some of the first Looney Tunes cartoons, you know, and those were like, you just.
Yeah, there was
they
like,
were not made for kids.
No, they were never.
They were
made
not
for
made
kids.
For kids.
Yeah, that's true. Bugs Bunny and all them. Not really, not for kids.
Oh.
You know, I know. Well. So, Vanta, we have a few minutes left. Have we left anything out from the book? I mean, I'm like eager to start reading it. It's pretty big, right? How many pages? Probably like 800?
566. Yeah, it's a big book.
It is a big book, but you know what? Look.
You get a lot of stories in it. That's the thing.
Yeah,
you got Time of the Black Death is another one. That's my favorite time period. And one of the stories is set during that time.
Really went back in time. I mean, 1300 and wow.
Why don't we let her read a little bit from it?
No, I mean, that's like, you don't read out of books.
Yes, you do.
On a radio show. But I mean, people can read it. I just want to find out more about her. That's all.
You know what? I think I'm going to be doing a reading. I'll give this a quick little plug.
Yes.
On October 13th, which is Friday the 13th in October.
Nice.
Perfect, right?
Uh-huh.
At a bookstore called The Pipe and Thimble, and it's in Lomita. And we're talking about you should join us, actually. We're talking about having horror authors and authors in general sitting around the fire reading scary stories and then just inviting people to come and hang out. We'll connect.
Okay.
Nice because it makes a reading experience not a solo thing, right?
Yeah.
You can actually read with people, tell stories, listen to stories with other people. That's pretty interesting.
I do live readings on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of the author groups that I belong to.
Mm-hmm.
And then... years ago, I had one of my short stories acted out.
Oh, nice.
On radio.
Yeah.
Which was a weird thing. It was a very weird thing. I read it as it was being acted out, but nobody who was listening knew what was going on, except for the ridiculousness of what was happening when I was, because the actors were trying to do the story as I was reading it out loud, so it was completely like you know, spontaneous. They didn't know. They didn't have the information beforehand. Uh-huh. But anyway, it was on, do you know the Dr. Susie show? Do you know Dr.
Yeah,
so I acted it out on the Dr. Susie show.
Oh,
very
okay.
cool.
I read it out loud while people were acting it out, so.
Yeah.
Very much like improv or old-time radio or something like that.
I think it was a high concept thing. It was too hard to do, really. It was a stretch, but it was so funny. It was actually more funny than it was erotic.
Now, I wanted to ask you, Vanta, I mean, you, obviously, a book like this, you have a lot of characters, right? How do you keep track of the characters, you know? I mean, that's really, like, interesting to me, to develop a new character, to even think about it, and then to have so many different ones, right? How do you do that? I mean, how do you get into other people's shoes, you know?
That's fun part, right?
Yeah.
Where you really create, you start with a basic construct. A lot of times we just have archetypes. You know, we all know that there are different archetypes. Take Father Michel, a priest during the time of the Black Death, trying to save people but not being able to.
What a terrible situation.
You know, and that's when you have that character, then the conflict starts to revolve around that character.
Right.
You know,
the story sort of like writes itself when you have the character. Wow.
Right. And then the questioning of belief, you know, a priest is obviously a good character to do that, but during the time of the Black Death, everybody was losing their faith.
My God, right?
People were dropping like flies.
Yeah.
Right. What was it, like 40% of the people were killed in Europe,
they say,
right?
Even more than
even
that
more
in
than
some
that?
Cases.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have the exact numbers.
Right.
But the cool thing about the Black Death is that it gave rise to the Reformation after that. And the Renaissance, I should say.
Renaissance.
Because, you know, you literally got rid of the feudal system where you didn't have people that were being oppressed because there weren't as many people left.
Right.
People weren't, you know, they didn't have to be a serf or a peasant anymore.
Right.
There was lots of land to be, you know, found.
Right.
And people really started to kind of rise out of the ashes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're totally out of time.
Okay.
Vanta M. Black, go to the website. What is the website again?
VantaMBlack.com. That's VantaMBlack.com.
There you go. And get the book. I'm ready for a good novel.
Definitely.
Okay, I'm going to dive into this one.
Wonderful.
And, we'll see.
And I read a couple of pages and I got sucked in pretty quickly. She's a very...
You're not supposed to be reading on the show. Shut up.
I wanted her to read aloud.
Okay, well, you know, there's so much to talk about. People can read it themselves, you know. And go to the reading in Lomita if you want to.
There you go.
And maybe you'll have an audio book of this one day.
Yes.
So then you can hear it. All right. Well, Vanta, thank you so much for joining us.
Much success
to you with the book. Looking forward to future ones as well. Everybody go out and get Oubliette. You can go to her website or to Amazon. And if you want to be scared, that's the way to go. Kay, thank you so much.
Hopefully
we'll see you back next week.
Yes, I can't
wait. Work it out.
Yeah.
And because Rachel's going to be out for a while. She will be in for the rest of this week. So if you're a Rachel fan, you know, we're not like keeping you waiting too long, but you will be gone next week. So we're lining up the great talent, and Kay is tops.
Oh,
there you go. Thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Rachel exclusively on LA Talk Radio.